That's right, everybody. It is Radio Orbit. My name is Mike Hagan. Pleasure to be with you all tonight at straight up midnight on September 11th, 2007. It's the sixth anniversary of the attacks in New York City on the World Trade Center towers, the Pentagon in Washington, and another plane that went down in Pennsylvania. And who knows what really happened with that. But at any rate, my guest tonight is Kent Daniel Benkowski. He's an independent researcher. He's a courageous guy who's been treading where very few people would tend to tread. And it's a pleasure to have him on the program tonight. Before we say hello to Kent, I'll read one quick thing from his blog that sort of sums up the type of guy he is, and then we'll get on with the program. He says, "Dissent is patriotic, and as such, I am exercising my First Amendment right of free speech in this second American Revolution to save the United States of America and its Constitution." Kent Daniel Benkowski, welcome to Radio Orbit. Thanks so much for being here, Kent.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the phone, and a pleasure to have you from Buffalo, New York, or thereabouts, at 1 o'clock in the morning. So thanks for sticking up late into the night with us.
Oh, no problem.
Well, Kent, before we get too deeply into this, it is the sixth anniversary of the events of September 11, 2001. Before we talk too much about detail, I'd like to know just a little bit about the background, about what your situation was. I'm always interested in hearing what people were doing and what was going on in their own life and what they thought when the whole thing went down originally, because obviously that made you think about some things to keep looking into it afterwards. So maybe a little bit about, as much as you want, about yourself and what happened to you personally on that day on September 11, 2001.
Yeah, sure. What happened is my wife had gotten up early that morning. I had been working on a writing project the night before, and it was pretty late into the night when I got to sleep. So I was asleep, and she had gotten up before me, turned on the television news, and started screaming from the living room, "Get up, you got to come out here, and you got to see this." And she was so distraught. And I immediately got up, and I went into the living room. And this was just after the first tower had been hit.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking about that on one of the news channels. I think it was NBC News. And so that's where I started that morning. I started watching all of this news coverage from that moment and throughout the entire rest of the day. She had to go to work at 3 o'clock, and I stayed with the news coverage right up until the time she got home at about 11:30 at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew in my heart immediately, as soon as I saw the second tower hit, the towers collapse, and especially what happened at 5:20 p.m. with WTC-7, you know, there was definitely something going on far beyond this explanation which was given that day. We were attacked by these Arab terrorists from a cave in Afghanistan with a laptop computer. And I thought that was completely ridiculous. And in fact, since then, I've written quite a bit about that issue. And how it's impossible for that to have happened without these individuals accessing national security codes and so forth. And so that's basically how I come into the 9/11 picture.
Okay. Kent, let me give out your website.
Mm-hmm.
People, if you want to link over to Kent's site, you can do it directly through my site there on the front page. You can link right over there. Of course, you know how to do that. But if you want to go and put it in your bookmarks, it is Kentroversy Papers. That's Kentroversy. Kentroversypapers.blogspot.com. And, Kent, how long have you been doing the blog?
I started the blog in June of 2005.
And you've been doing research obviously longer than that, but this is when you decided to put your stuff up on the web?
Yes. I've been doing research since 1980.
What have you been interested in prior to the most recent research?
Well, back in 1980, I worked as an assistant librarian at one of the library branches here in Buffalo. I got trained by my supervisor on how to, do all the business inside a library. And one of the things I expressed an interest in was research, just because I have a high intellect and that sort of thing had always interested me. So I started there, and I started right away with government issues. I always had a mistrust of the government. In fact, Mike, my very first memory of my entire life is the Kennedy assassination, which took place the day before my second birthday.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I was born in August of 64, so it had happened just 9 months. I was probably conceived right about the time that that he got publicly assassinated, but wow.
Yeah, so that event haunted me throughout my childhood and throughout my teen years, and that actually was the very first piece of research that I did, was the JFK assassination.
You know, it's amazing that that we're still talking about that, you know, that we, at least me, I'm still not convinced of any particular story. I've heard many different descriptions of what might have happened to President Kennedy, but again, this is something that happened 43 years ago, and the general public certainly has no idea what happened on that day.
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't have the type of technology that we do today. 9/11 appears to be the most photographed event of all time. And if the Kennedy situation had that same type of opportunity, maybe we would have more answers.
Right. What, between you and me and the whoever's listening, what do you make of the Kennedy thing?
Well, actually, it appears that it was a coup d'etat by a group of individuals who now refer to themselves as the neocons, and an individual who played a very high role in this situation, the assassination, was George Bush Sr. A few months ago, I did a report about the Kennedy assassination, which you can get on my website. And I have a photograph of George Bush Sr. standing outside of the Texas School Book Depository building right outside the front door at the very moment after the assassination occurred. Also, he was debriefed by the FBI a week after the assassination. That has been revealed through the Freedom of Information Act. And those documents are also available on the Internet.
Okay. Yeah, so it turns out that things are linked way back, apparently.
Yeah. And in fact, from 1963 until now, this is a definite series of events that can be linked and traced together that are related and do actually involve the same cast of characters as we go through the decades.
Yeah, it's amazing how you see the same names pop up over and over again, you know?
Yeah.
And they may not be particularly people who are, you know, holding positions in government even, but, you know, the Kissingers and Brzezinskis and all these types of people, they always show up and they're being interviewed and everybody sort of, you know, rolls out the red carpet for them. But it's like, my God, these are just nefarious characters, you know?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Mike, in 1986, one of my cousins married into a family here in the Buffalo area who is associated with the Bush crime family. And I've heard many stories about these people, and they are nothing short of evil.
I've heard plenty of my own stories, trust me. And, and you know, I hesitate to judge because I don't know. In other words, I've been told lots and lots of stories, and some of, you know, some turn out to be true, some don't. But certainly, there's a whole lot of questions that I think need to be answered for sure. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, as far as 9/11 is concerned, what I tried to do with my entire research that I do on my website is try to look at aspects of the story that no one else wants to touch or talk about. And I've done that, and I thought that tonight we could talk about some of those issues. After we spoke earlier this afternoon, I drew up an outline of some of these issues, and I think I have some surprising information for your listeners tonight.
All right. Well, you start anywhere you like, and you can just sort of jump into it. What would you like to talk about to begin with?
Well, I think we can start with Larry Silverstein. Mm-hmm. And 9/11 actually is the largest, most valuable case of insurance fraud that this country has ever seen. In April of 2001, April 26th, to be specific, Larry Silverstein and his partners negotiated for a 99-year lease on the World Trade Center complex.
Who owns the World Trade Center complex?
Right at this time, Larry Silverstein owns the property.
But they leased it, you said?
It is, the owner. Okay, that's the Port Authority of New York City.
Huh. Which is essentially the Vatican, by the way.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So we got Silverstein and the Vatican involved. We could just stop the show right there.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I don't want to do that. I'm just kidding.
They're paying a rent of $125 million a month for this property, by the way. So this lease deal was finalized on July 24th, which was about 6 weeks before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
What happened here is the World Trade Center was slated for demolition, and the cost was about $10 billion, they estimated. There were many problems with the structure. It was outdated, and it had problems with asbestos and other structural issues. So they literally were going to have to take this thing apart, like piece by piece, just as they had built it. And this is why it would have cost like around $10 billion to, dismantle the building.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is Silverstein comes along, he gets this lease, puts a $3.2 billion bid down, only contributes $14 million of his own money, by the way, and gets an insurance policy for $8 billion. So he profited immensely by this 9/11 going down. The lender of the money for all this was GMAC, and this actually contributed to the bankruptcy of General Motors. They're in very dire straits financially at the moment.
Yeah.
The investment of Silverstein and his partners was a total of $125 million dollars. As I said, $14 million was from Silverstein himself.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing, excuse me, pretty much was a complete fraud and a complete ripoff of about 10 different insurance companies. He sought between $7.2 and $8 billion payout for the policies that he held. He was sued by these insurance companies and still took home $4.55 billion. So as you see, there's a tremendous profit here to these people, this man and his partners.
How much do we know about Silverstein and the people that he hangs around with?
Not much. It's very difficult to find information on this guy. And in terms of that, I had looked into this and was pretty much stonewalled every direction that I went. You know, these type of backroom operators, as you pointed out a few minutes ago with the Kissingers and the Brzezinskis and so forth, they like to hide and they like to conceal details of their business activities. Oftentimes, you know, they're illegal and they don't want the people to know about them. Larry Silverstein is definitely one of these type of people.
Okay, so what about his connection to government? There's a lot of talk about, or a lot of questions, I guess I should say, about knowledge, foreknowledge in government agencies that you know, whether it was President Bush or whether it was Dick Cheney or Rumsfeld or whoever, but that there was there's a lot of discussion about someone, some rogue agency, some group of people, someone in the agencies of the U.S. administration that knew what was going on and perhaps were even, you know, a part of the whole thing.
I have a source who's an attorney who claims that this operation was right out of the Oval Office, overseen by George Bush Jr. personally. I believe that to be true. And the reason I do believe this, Mike, is because there is such a tremendous benefit to George Bush Jr. as a result of 9/11. Their agenda was greatly furthered by the events of that day.
Yeah, that's for sure. It appears so, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seemed that there was an agenda that was in place just waiting for the trigger event to allow the agenda to be implemented.
Yeah, that's right. We have the USA Patriot Act, which is an 800-plus page law that was within a month of 9/11 is plopped down before Congress, and there's no possible way that they could have designed, written, drafted, amended, revised that type of a very detailed bill within that amount of time. So that alone points to foreknowledge.
Yeah, and so few of our congresspeople even managed to look at the damn thing before they bought into it.
Yeah, in fact, they were, you know, their patriotism was questioned. They were basically force-fed this and told that if they did not vote for this, that would be looked upon as treasonous behavior.
You know, it's I was speaking earlier in the program about how my other friend Kent Stedman,
mm-hmm.
who is probably listening right now, but anyway, he and I talked very early on the mornings of on the morning of September 11th in 2001, and he's someone that I look to for guidance often, and for, you know, I respect his opinion and all this stuff. And I called him, and I said, "What's going on, Kent?" And he said, "Reichstag." It was the first words out of his mouth. He was certain that that this was a job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a long, long time after that, you know, and a lot of evidence from lots of different sources has seemed to point in that direction. I still, you know, I would never say that I know exactly what was going on, and it seems like there were probably many different agendas that were all sort of unfolding at the same time. Lots of birds apparently killed with the same stone, maybe.
Yes, yes. In fact, one of the interesting things about government foreknowledge that I happened to dig up is there's this individual by the name of Timothy McNiven who has a website called Codename Grillfire. In 1976, this individual had participated in a government study which was for the purpose of improving both U.S. airport and air traffic and air travel security. And what the point of this study was to design different scenarios of flying planes into high-rise buildings, specifically the World Trade Center. So when a person like Condoleezza Rice claims that she had never heard of plans to fly planes into buildings, she's a complete liar. Plans have been on the books since 1976. That was only 3 years after the World Trade Center had opened for business. And almost from the beginning of its existence, this building complex was slated for some sort of a nefarious ending, if you will.
You know, that whole business of Condoleezza Rice and people saying that, you know, we never even imagined that anything like this could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what was actually happening that morning. There were at least two, I think, dry runs for intelligence agencies that were doing, I don't know, an exercise, I guess they call it, right?
Yeah, like the war gaming.
Right. Now, a bunch of that stuff was going on that morning,
yeah.
Right? Maybe
yeah.
You could talk a little bit about that. That's one of the things that I found that so few people knew about, that there were actually war game exercises that were going on that morning that were very similar to what actually occurred.
Yeah, these were being run out of the Port Authority dock on the shore of Manhattan. And the interesting thing about this is we have individuals from the government flying into New York City the night before on September 10th who were from FEMA and other agencies like this, and they were flying in to participate in these war game exercises. And so you have this going on, and these false flag attacks, as they're referred to, always include this component so that there's an opportunity for these things to go live, as it were, so that they go from an exercise to an actual terrorist attack or the appearance of a terrorist attack. My personal opinion is 9/11 was a complete inside job. No Arabs involved beyond the hijackers.
Kent, for the people who don't know what false flag refers to, could you describe that a little bit further?
Yeah, sure. What a false flag attack is you have an enemy that you target, let's say Iraq, for example, and you have an event such as a bomb going off in a city, and then this country of Iraq is blamed for this attack, and when, in fact, the whole thing was carried out by agents of the CIA or some covert group within the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
To get to 9/11 as a specific example, you know, right away they blame Osama bin Laden, which is very interesting to me, because at the time they were doing this, this man was already pretty much dead. He passed away in December of 2001.
Really? You believe Osama bin Laden was actually documented as dead, huh?
Yes.
Huh.
In fact, on the internet, there was an article that was posted from one of the Arabian newspapers that was an article describing his funeral service. And this was in December of 2001.
Huh.
Died of kidney failure.
Wow, that's pretty interesting, because I know there was another story, one of the most provocative, I thought, that came out shortly after 9/11 was, oh, I think it was in Dubai, and it was a story that came out from a French newspaper, but it basically reported that bin Laden, in July of 2001, just 6 weeks or so before the September 11th attacks, was actually visiting an American hospital in Dubai and was visited by the local CIA guy.
Yeah, that's correct.
And that was documented. I mean, and mm-hmm. that's one that's never really been explained to me. So bin Laden obviously did have, and he was there for dialysis. He was there for his kidney issues.
And so we
know that he certainly did have kidney issues, and then at the same time we know that he was still communicating with CIA, and we know he has roots there to begin with.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, during the Afghanistan USSR war in the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
He was a CIA asset. Using the code name Tim Osman,
O-S-M-A-N, yeah.
And he had been a part of this group that was known as the Mujahideen,
mm-hmm.
and they were kind of morphed into Al-Qaeda, which, you know, conveniently served the agenda and the purposes of the Bush administration, or let me correct myself, the Bush regime. Perhaps a better word for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so from that time until his death, he was definitely a CIA asset.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. You know, and I've heard plenty of people say, once CIA, always CIA.
Yeah, it's a lifetime gig.
Yeah, hard to get out of that gang, you know?
The only way you get out is feet first. And I've heard that from actual CIA operatives that I've spoken to.
Right. Well, all right. Let's talk about the actual event itself. I'll tell you what. We're bottom of the hour. Let's take a little break, okay?
Yeah, sure.
And we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more. But I want to talk about the actual hijackings themselves, the idea of the 19 Arab guys and what you think about that, and maybe we can talk a little bit further, okay?
Sure thing.
Hey, Kent, back to you here. How are you?
I'm fine.
All right. You staying awake out there in New York?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I work nights.
Huh.
I'm a night person.
All right, I am too. It's like I'm a complete night owl, and I can, I'm sort of a day sleeper, but unfortunately I don't get to sleep as much during the day as I'd like either, but I guess that's just the way it goes these days.
Yeah, a lot on our mind.
I think so, for sure. I'm hoping for a little bit of a reprieve one of these days. I don't know if we're going to get it, but we'll see. Hey, let's talk about the actual sort of operation itself. The story that we're told is that there were 19 hijackers, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone knows the story, and that they basically, you know, took over the planes with box cutters and then just did their thing. I read a story in the BBC from sometime in 2002 that said that 7 of the 19 guys were still alive.
Yeah, exactly. What happened with these individuals is that they stole the identities of people who later turned out to be alive.
Mm.
And this caused, you know, quite a ruckus in the families of these individuals. They contacted news organizations saying
that this is not me.
You know, and so forth. And
whatever came of any of it?
Well, you know, the BBC kind of dropped the story at that point. And see, any time one of these stories goes in a direction that does not benefit the agenda or the establishment, it magically disappears. When it does advance the agenda, it's rammed down our throats 24/7.
Hmm.
And you see this on the American mass media, whether it's the news, TV, or the radio, or the public publications, you know, like the newspapers and magazines, and the internet.
You mentioned that Bin Laden, in your opinion, was actually dead. And we have now, just recently, two more messages that supposedly came from this guy, videotapes that are released by some sort of Al-Qaeda production company. they always know that a representative of Al-Qaeda delivered a new videotape. It always sort of cracks me up. It reminds me of sort of like the movie Airplane or something, where it's so silly that...
It was the logo on the car.
So, I don't know. Is this all just theater?
I've examined these videos every time they've come out, and there's one thing that I've identified in these, and if you look at them real closely, and I also happen to be a film buff, and I'm very interested in how Hollywood movies are made, and you may be familiar with the term green screen.
I'm not.
Well, it's a type of a way that you can put a background into a film or a videotape footage, which would alter the location of what you're seeing.
Huh.
And, for instance, in a movie like The Lord of the Rings, a lot of these battle scenes and so forth were all computer-generated. And they were using these green screen techniques where an actor will stand on a stage that is completely green, and every part that's colored green is blocked out and replaced with these battle scenes, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same thing with these Bin Laden videotapes. You look at the edge of the man's body, for instance, his turban and his face and cheeks and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a faint, like, remnants of this green screen technique. So what I believe they're doing here is they're using old footage and they are changing the background to make it look like he is being photographed in different locations, when in fact it could be some sort of a stage setting where he was originally filmed.
Hmm.
For instance, the latest videotape that was released just recently, there is a whole section where the video just freezes, and there is an audio section where the thing is like paused, and what happens at that point is they inserted into this tape these references to these current events.
The congressional elections and all this sort of thing.
Yeah, like the 62nd anniversary of the bombing of Japan.
Right.
And so forth. And all of those things did not occur before the man's death. So they have to fabricate these. And that's what I believe they're doing, the videotapes.
So they're just sort of maintaining the illusion is what they're trying to do with this sort of thing.
Yeah, every war needs a boogeyman or an enemy. And he's the figurehead boogeyman for the war on terror. And they need this type of an opponent so that they can justify the billions upon billions of dollars that they're spending on this complete sham.
Amazing. So the hijacker scenario. Do you actually think that that's actually what happened? That the planes actually were hijacked, but the hijackers either were not under the command of certainly not Osama bin Laden, or maybe they didn't. Who do you think was actually calling the shots, and did the hijackers actually know what they were involved in? You know, they compartmentalize all this stuff so much. I mean, who knows what was actually going on?
Well, Mike, the thing is this whole operation has CIA through the entire thing. And the interesting thing is that Bush Sr. once again shows up the night before on September 10th at the White House. He spends the night at the White House. He went to a early morning meeting for the Carlyle Group on September 11th.
Nice bunch of guys over there.
Yeah, absolutely. After this, he has, or at this meeting, rather, he has breakfast with none other than Osama bin Laden's brother. Okay? He goes back to the White House, where he spends the entire day in the White House Situation Room. So because of his past behavior, as I described with the Kennedy assassination, and don't forget, this man is a former director of the CIA.
Yeah, 1972 or 73, something like that.
It was during
Gerald Ford's administration. Right.
It was like 76 to 80, I think. And so because of this, I believe that he was one of the people calling the shots that day.
Very interesting. You know, Cheney and Rumsfeld were just showing up on the scene right around that time, too, in the early 70s. And they were involved in all kinds of nasty business back then, too. This one particular story, I won't take too much of a left turn, but, you know, the Frank Olson story. If you're not familiar with it, Frank Olson was a government scientist who was essentially murdered. But Rumsfeld, this is back in the 50s where he was killed, but the cover-up continued for years until his family pushed it so hard that they had to settle in some way, shape, or form. And Gerald Ford actually did this with the Olson family, but Rumsfeld and Cheney were both involved in a continued cover-up that goes on to this day with what happened with Frank Olson.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, the way these people have been emboldened and they're so full of themselves at this point in time, they would probably just kill whoever stood in their way. They wouldn't settle at this point. Their psychosis is way off the charts at this stage.
All right, so CIA, you imagine, was involved. The actual perps on the plane, whether that part of the story is legitimate or not, really is sort of minutia. I mean, the fact is that I tend to think that the first thing to do is just to take a general look at the whole thing and say, all right, I'm not going to, you know, obviously something's very strange is going on, but the first thing that we have to show is that the official story has been bunk. You know, it's that we've been sold a line. And once, you know, once we realize that we haven't been told the truth, well, then finding out what the truth maybe becomes a little bit easier.
Yeah, so it's a process of elimination. And it's something that I go through in my research. You know, you collect a set of data, and you have this data sitting in front of you, and you have to make a judgment as to what fits logically and what doesn't fit logically. And through that process of elimination, that's where I come to make the judgments and the decisions on, you know, what I believe happened, and that informs my writing to do it that way.
All right, number 7, World Trade Center Tower number 7, or building number 7, I guess. As much as you'd like to, talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I think one of the interesting aspects of WTC 7 is the security firm, Securicom, also known as Stratesec, had as one of its board members Marvin P. Bush, who is one of George W. Bush's younger brothers.
Right.
This man was in New York City on 9/11. The clients for this security firm were the World Trade Center, United Airlines, the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Department of Justice. Those were like their top star clients, the people that they would, you know, basically brag about. This building fell after not being hit by any airplane or anything major many hours after the 9/11 attacks of that morning at 5:20 in the afternoon. And if you look at the film footage for this and the videotapes that were taken of that event, we find that, number one, the BBC was reporting that this building was going to come down a half an hour before it did, which was at 10 to 5, okay?
Yeah, in the evening that day, right?
Yeah, yes. We also have this thing looking exactly like a controlled demolition. These film footages that we see of the old Vegas hotels being knocked down when they've rebuilt or replace them with newer and bigger hotels and so forth. So I think that if we look at that footage again, we find that there were almost no fires in the building, and the fires that were there were oxygen starved. That's what all the black smoke is about. When a fire is not being fed properly, it will give black smoke because it doesn't have enough oxygen to feed the flames. And so we have that situation going on. Some of the tenants in that building were Rudolph Giuliani's security services. We also had several government agencies that were in that building, such as FEMA and, you know, other high-level government departments. And it just is very suspicious, and it has not been explained to this day what exactly happened to this building, except for that one statement that Larry Silverstein made when he referred to, we had to pull the building. This is another reference to controlled demolition. Another interesting thing is that the company that got hired to clean up the entire WTC complex after the attacks is a company called Controlled Demolition Incorporated.
They did the Oklahoma City cleanup, by the way.
Yes, they did. And so that is very, very suspicious.
And just for the practical observer, like you say, Ken, anybody who's seen a controlled demolition, I mean, and then you watch number 7, I mean, I don't know who out there in their right mind could look at that and say that that was not a controlled demolition. I mean, it just, you know, if it looks like a duck, et cetera, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I really believe that. And there was no other reason for that building to go down. I mean, there's no reason for that thing to go down. It wasn't hit by any plane. It wasn't hit by anything. It had, you know, if anything, a couple little fires or something like you say. But it was a steel-framed 42-story building or whatever. A big, giant building.
Yeah, 47.
47 stories.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Another interesting thing about 9/11 is that it was actually predicted, the attacks were predicted and depicted in 1995. There is this company that makes these card games such as Magic, The Gathering, those type of games.
Mm-hmm.
They're from Texas and they're called Steve Jackson Games. They have this game called, and I'm not making this up because I have all this on my website. You can look at this. Any of your listeners can look at this. I have all the pictures and everything. They have a game called Illuminati New World Order. And in this game, it's a card game that has 110 cards. It's a role-playing game. And what happens is, you know, you go through and you take turns with the people you're playing with. And the object is to conquer the world, just like the new world order and the Illuminati of conspiracy theory.
So that's what we need to do with these guys, just create a little virtual reality, put them all in the little room. They can live out their little, you know, obsessive, freakish fantasies as much as they like, but they won't hurt anyone, you know?
Yeah. So in this game, there's a series of cards that show World Trade Center attacks, and this was published in 1995. They have this one card called Terrorist Nuke, which I think is interesting. It shows two towers standing right next to one another. The tower on the right-hand side has a explosion about three-quarters of the way to the top. It's the top of the building is leaning over, just like it did on 9/11, and it talks about how this was a nuclear explosion that actually took place and that this was a terrorist attack that used this nuclear bomb to bring these buildings down. The caption that I put under this artwork of this card says, could this be anything other than the World Trade Center? And I would have to say no. Other cards in this shows the attack on the Pentagon, for one example. And it talks on this card, which is simply entitled Pentagon, it talks about how corporations control the Pentagon. And of course, they're talking about the military-industrial complex. There's a card entitled Goal, Population Reduction. Again, the New York City skyline is shown. The two World Trade Center towers are shown in green, which is kind of like this glowing nuclear glow, and it has a cloud over it in the shape of a skull. This card talks about killing for Cthulhu, which is a reptilian monster of H.P. Lovecraft's fiction. H.P. Lovecraft being a horror fiction writer from the 50s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Ted Turner, the guy who started CNN, in an interview with Audubon magazine in November-December 1991 issue, had made the following statement about population reduction. He said, "The total world population of 250 to 300 million people, a 95% decline from present levels, would be ideal." Prince Philip, Queen Elizabeth's husband, had said, "If I were reincarnated, I would wish to be returned to Earth as a killer virus to lower population levels." This is the mindset of these people.
Yeah, a 95% reduction. I mean, that means that everybody dies, essentially. I mean, you don't get that sort of population reduction without a tremendous amount of violence and bloodshed of some sort.
Exactly. Other cards in this game show the quarantine and the epidemic, which is the anthrax attacks shortly after 9/11. It also shows attacks on London, for example. And probably the strangest card of all says goal, kill for peace. And there's a saying, which I really can't say the way it's actually said, but killing for peace is like having sex for celibacy. And so that's an interesting card as well. The very last card is entitled Tape Runs Out. And this says time has run out. And it talks about how, you know, our time is drawing to a close, and very soon something bad is going to be happening. So there appears to be a time frame associated with this, a timeline. And again, this game was published in 1995, and this was, I tried to get an interview with Steve Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
This business of his, Steve Jackson Games, is located in Austin, Texas. And I also had a couple friends of mine from Austin approach him for me as well in person. And he refused to do any interviews whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame him,
right,
you know,
right,
not wanting to talk about this.
You know, I remember one other thing that I saw that was sort of similar. There was a music group, a hip-hop group that was called The Coup.
Yep.
And they had an album cover that was released shortly before 9/11 that was like these two kids with a remote control in their hands and planes flying into the World Trade Center.
Yep.
What do you make of that? But coincidence or what the hell?
Well, I'll tell you, if it's coincidence, it's an awfully big coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, you couldn't paint a picture more clear, you know?
Yeah, I think these things are done to condition the public and to prepare them for things to come.
Mm-hmm.
And this is done to the subconscious. For example, the 9/11 attacks were shown on a television show called The Lone Gunman.
That's right. It was a spinoff of The X-Files, right?
The X-Files spinoff. Yeah. And that was shown in March of 2001.
Uh-huh.
And they actually, in that episode, talk about how the attack on the World Trade Center, which involves a jet airplane flying into the buildings would be used for the creation of a false, bogus war on terror. And that's exactly what happened.
Amazing. All right, Ted, that's a good place to take a break, okay?
Yep.
How are things there in Buffalo, New York, by the way, these days? What's the sort of feeling of the general population and stuff with regard to the stuff that we've been talking to? Over the last couple of days, I've been asking people, you know, what they think about 9/11, what their thoughts are on this and that. And interestingly, I've had a number of people, most people actually, were just sort of like surprised. I say, well, you know, tomorrow's the anniversary now. Oh, yeah, it is. And some people feel that it's just sort of too late to worry about. I do not feel that way. I feel that it's the most pressing of issues. But what are you finding out there in your own adventures?
Yeah, I've been finding that people are, you know, oh, that's in the past, and we should leave that in the past, and let's move on to other things now. And I'm being asked, you know, why am I still worried about something that happened 6 years ago? And I tell them, hey, I'm still worried about something that happened 43 years ago,
right,
and that's
right.
The Kennedy assassination.
Right. If people would have followed through with that, we probably wouldn't be in the situation we're in now.
I believe that's exactly the case, yes. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's sort of an uphill battle for people that are doing this sort of work. What in your personal life have you? What's your experience has been? I mean, has it been something that's been difficult for you, or has it been, you know, no problem and just another thing that you've been doing? Or?
Well, I'll tell you, I've, you know, lost a lot of friends over the research and the journalism that I do, because a lot of people cannot confront the issues and they have a difficult time digesting some of this information. And however, the people that have left my life have been replaced with other people who are on the same page as I am and actually have become better friends to me than the ones I lost. So overall, it's been a positive thing, I believe. Also, this is something that I'm compelled to do. This, to me, is an issue of moral imperative. You know, Bush is constantly talking about, you know, we're doing this in the name of the American people and so forth. And, you know, that does not represent me. And I don't want my name being used as a complicit excuse for all of these evil deeds that these people are doing. It's my job to speak out against this. And I actually thought and came to the conclusion about 3 years ago that I would actually be, if I continued to stay silent about this, an accessory after the fact to real crimes that are being committed in the name of the American people, and that includes myself. And I can't do that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation, Kent.
Well, thank you. You know, it's something that was quite a revelation to me, and when I came to that conclusion, that's when I made the decision to go forward and to begin plans for what I do today.
All right. Okay, remember John O'Neill?
Yes.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about John O'Neill. I think that was a pretty interesting part of the story that very few people are familiar with.
Yeah, John O'Neill was an individual who worked for the FBI, and he...
Director, right? Former director.
He had gone and had voiced many problems with what was going on in the country at that time. He was manipulated into the position of the World Trade Center. I forget what position it was.
He was head of security.
Yeah, head of security. Okay. And he had, at that point, his very first day of work was 9/11 itself.
Mm-hmm.
He perished in the attack.
Yeah, his first day of work after leaving the FBI.
Yeah.
And he was sort of chased out of the FBI.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, yeah, that's again, it's sort of like we were talking about a little bit earlier, no pun intended, killing more than one bird with one act, with one stone.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was trouble for a whole lot of people in that administration.
Yeah, and that is the MO of these people, is they remove these obstacles and they do not care about human life. Unfortunately, and we see this in Iraq right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Almost 1 million Iraqis have perished in this current, I can't even call it a war because it really isn't, but this whole travesty that's going on down there is just atrocious, and it should not be, definitely. And you know, so John O'Neill died on 9/11 itself, and in doing that, they removed a big obstacle for themselves and a very big vocal opponent to the administration. And, you know, we see this happening time after time. For instance, there were over 100 deaths of microbiologists who were vocal against the anthrax attacks and so forth, and perhaps could have had some answers and some real solutions to some of the most troubling problems with microbiology,
right.
And they were just completely wiped off the face of the earth.
Right. Well, there's some progress being made on that side too, I think, and I really mean that. So yeah, they've been involved with all kinds of just untold nastiness. But you know, there's a lot of good people out there that are doing some really good work too. And I'm not completely hopeless about the situation. I actually feel that the fact that you and me are here talking about it, and you know, we're not the only ones, means that, you know, it's not all lost, perhaps.
Well, the good thing that I see going on is the research community has really grown in the past handful of years, and I have had the opportunity to become acquainted with a lot of these people, and they are extremely dedicated, extremely serious about what they're doing. And this is the type of people that we need on our side at this point.
Right, I agree. I agree.
And this does appear to give a tremendous amount of hope from where I sit.
Okay.
And I think that in the end, we will reign victorious.
Well, I hope you're right, and I think that you are. Ken, here's a question that comes in email.
Mm-hmm.
And the person asks, it says, Mike, you've been talking about killing more than one bird with one stone. He said, are you familiar with the COMEX gold and silver stores that were held in the basement of the World Trade Center buildings? I've heard numerous stories that the gold and silver was gone. Then I've heard people say that it was not gone. Can you or Kent discuss the COMEX? Are you familiar with COMEX?
Yes.
Maybe, I mean, you're probably more familiar with it than I am. I know a little bit about it, but please, if you could, talk a little bit about it.
Yeah. Pretty much what happened here is that in the days leading up to the attack on 9/11 itself, there were several very mysterious happenings that took place in the towers. One of them being that they pulled all the bomb-sniffing dogs out. They shut down the towers for a weekend, which I believe was the time where they wired all the explosives and so forth to bring the towers down through these controlled demolitions. During this same time, there were, I forget what it was, a couple $100 million or maybe even more than that, where's the gold and silver in this COMEX storage facility in these safes in the basement, and those were moved out of there. They were completely taken out and moved to an alternative location, which nobody seems to know where it is. So this, I'm pretty sure, was just outright theft.
Just a heist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it looks like and smells like to me.
Okay. Let's see. All right. You mentioned that these strange events in the building, in the buildings leading up to the events, where they were shut down for the weekend, dogs removed, this sort of thing. Your opinion is that the buildings were demolished in a systematic fashion through explosives, and that the planes were perhaps just to get everyone's attention and for the theater of it.
Yes, in fact, what makes me believe this are the satellite photos that were taken a week later. On the 16th to the 20th of September, which actually showed that there were certain areas where the towers stood that were measuring like 1,000 degrees plus in temperature. There's no possible way a fire from kerosene, which is basically what jet fuel is, could burn for a week at those high temperatures. So when I looked at those thermal maps and examined all that data, the only conclusion that I could come to at that point that could create such a result was some sort of a bomb. Because there's nothing else that could create that type of a situation over a week later.
Hmm. Amazing. All right. You were one of the few, frankly, you were the only journalist out there that actually listened to and considered the information that Paul Laffoley had talked about on my program, actually, as relevant. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that, because I thought one of the things, you know, I really wasn't, and I think you knew this when you heard it, is that I had no intention when I talked to Paul about talking, you know, to this stuff. We were talking about art and this sort of stuff that night. I wasn't interested in talking politics or any of this stuff. It just sort of came out when I asked him about his background.
Mm-hmm.
But afterwards, that little clip that was 10 minutes long or so circulated all around the 9/11 community and all the 9/11 truth people, and I got all kinds, I can't tell you the email I got. I got all kinds of emails from all kinds of different people and very interested in it, this, that, and the other thing. But when push came to shove, no one, not one other journalist, not no one from TV, not no one else from radio, not no one from the newspapers, ever went to talk to Paul Laffoley. And I thought, well, man, this is a guy that people should want to talk to. And, you know, because I didn't really get to the bottom of it with him. I think he knows much more than he told me. And maybe I'm not good enough at digging that stuff. But I mean, I was like, well, that's enough. I didn't need to hear anymore. But many people, you know, criticize me for not questioning him further or whatever. But at any rate, maybe you could talk a little bit about what you thought about that whole business and if it even fits into your any of your scenarios.
Yeah, well, first of all, I listened to that interview because Paul happens to be one of my very favorite artists.
Well, he's a remarkable guy and an incredible artist and architect, yeah.
He's just amazing, and I have his piece, Thanaton 3.
So you were a Laffoley fan before you heard that?
Oh, yes.
That is remarkable, yeah. Kent.
Yeah, I've been a fan of his for years.
Holy cow.
And
well, I didn't even know who he was. I had interviewed this other artist. His name is Alex Gray, right?
Uh-huh.
He's
uh-huh.
a big fancy artist in New York, and a lot of people talk about how wonderful he is, and I like his work and everything. And I talk a little bit about some ideas that he's interested in, and I interviewed him, and I was very pleased with myself for having interviewed Alex Gray because everyone said, "Wow, that was a great interview." And one of my listeners sent me a note and said, "Hey, you think Alex Gray is great? You should interview this guy, Paul Laffoley."
Yeah.
And I said, "Who's he?" And they sent me a little information and a couple of images mm-hmm. of artwork that he had done. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Give me his number, you know?" I mean, I couldn't wait to talk with him. And then, sure enough, all this other stuff came out of it. But that was I can't believe you were familiar with him long before this. Amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's remarkable. Okay, well, continue then, please.
And so that's why I tuned in the first place, because I was interested to hear a discussion about his artwork, you know? And so about 20, 22 minutes into this interview, you start talking about his background as an architect, and what comes next blew my mind. He starts talking about how he was involved with the World Trade Center and worked in New York City at a very prestigious design firm. And I'm just listening to this, and he's going into the details about how he, you know, just so happened to be asked, you know, how would you design a building and put these type of explosives into the building. And I'm like, wow, this is incredible what I'm hearing. It was so far left field from what I was expecting to hear that day that I listened to this. And I was just in awe, totally, okay? So I listened to the whole thing, the entire two-hour interview, and I go back after I'm done, and I play this section again where he talks about working on the World Trade Center, and I start taking notes, and I said, you know, I have to write an article about this because this is crucial. This is important. You know, working for Emery Roth and Sons, which was, you know, like a rock star type of architectural design firm.
Yeah, the biggie in New York for sure.
I mean, you know, you don't get any bigger than this.
Mm-hmm.
So I start writing this article, and I thought that this information was so important that it needed to be told. And I finished this article, I posted it on my website, and about a couple days after this, I get one of the comments at the bottom of the article is from Laffoley's webmaster. And he says, "I just want to thank you, you know, very much for talking about this and writing this, because this is very important, and I'm very happy that you did this." And I'm like, wow, this is really great. And I expected that perhaps this was going to have some legs, you know, because they noticed right away that I had done this.
Right.
And so as it comes to pass, you know, I'm kind of checking around different websites, you know, Lance and Alex Jones and so forth, and they're all tight-lipped. Nobody said anything about this.
I know. I was very, very, I found that very telling, frankly.
And it was extremely disturbing to me because it kind of told me that perhaps there were certain people who were professing to be truth tellers and, you know, members of the 9/11 truth movement and so forth that weren't exactly doing their job correctly. Let me just leave it at that. I could say much more.
No,
but
I think you've said enough, and I agree, frankly, with your position, because I made a tremendous amount of effort to share that information with a whole lot of people, and I was successful at sharing the information with a whole lot of people. And there are a whole lot of people who, when this whole thing finally does come clean, there's a whole lot of people who are not going to be able to say, "Well, I didn't know," because I'm going to be able to say, "Well, I told you." So we'll see how the whole thing pans out. But I tell you what, Ken, let's take another little break here. We'll let the music take hold of us for a couple minutes here, and then we'll come back. We'll have one more segment before we finish things up, okay?
Yes, sir.
A couple of questions that have come up during the break there that maybe we could get to. But first I'd like to ask you if there's anything that is on your list that we haven't gotten to yet that you want to make sure that you cover.
Yeah, actually there is, and thank you for bringing that up. The number one thing that I hear from people who do not want to believe or confront the reality of 9/11 as an inside job is the following statement. There never could have been such complete secrecy with so many people having been involved in the operation. And all governments are riddled with levels of secrecy, national security codes, and a management technique that is known as compartmentalization. This is where individuals are told small amounts of information only on a need-to-know basis, information that relates only to their own small part of the picture. This is done in a way so that only the highest level agents are aware of the bigger picture, and those lower in the management structure know only what they need to know to perform their small part of that bigger whole. Also, intelligence agents sign non-disclosure agreements. They take oaths of secrecy, and both of these are taken extremely seriously. These people are not even allowed or permitted to tell their spouse specific details about their job or their career. And the interesting thing about this is about 23 years ago, a certain female member of my family had married a man for a brief time who referred to himself as a consultant. And this guy would talk about going to all these foreign countries for these consulting meetings. And these countries were all the things we were hearing in the national news on a nightly basis. So one day we were having a family gathering. It was in the middle of the summer. And this consultant shows up with his new wife. He had just gotten back from Afghanistan. In fact, this was during the Mujahideen years when Afghanistan was fighting Russia. We had a barbecue cookout, and it was a birthday party for one of my other relatives. We were, my father and myself, were refilling our drinks at the bar, and this particular man walks up to my father and I, and we begin a conversation. Suddenly, without even warning, I blurt out the following question. "So, how long have you worked for the CIA?" I ask this individual. My father and I had been talking about this for several weeks. And it just seemed that it was awfully suspicious that this person was flying to all these countries that were in the news every night. And here we have this situation where this man suddenly disappears from my family. When an agent of the CIA gets outed, they have no choice but to have a reassignment of their duties. So because of this, I got myself into a ton of trouble. Because I was still kind of young, at that time I was in my early 20s, like I had the FBI visit me and the whole nine yards, and the CIA people came and talked to me and so forth, and some other government people. And here, this situation that I personally experienced showed me that a person could actually have this type of a position and his own wife would not know the details about what he was doing. And so this is the answer for 9/11. You know, the reason why there is secrecy here and the reason why they have gotten away with it is because of these oaths, these compartmentalization situations that had occurred where these people are forbidden to discuss publicly or even privately to their small circle of family, friends, or their very spouse, details of what they have been up to. And this certainly does apply to 9/11 as well.
Yeah, and it makes sense because, you know, that's the only thing that's missing. In other words, the only thing that's missing is a bunch of people saying, well, yeah, because it's not like it was a very clean job. There were a whole bunch of botches, and I mean, people like you and me and a whole bunch of other people have, you know, have come up, have been able to identify a whole bunch of questions that should be asked and that have been avoided and all this stuff. I mean, there were all kinds of mistakes that were made, but you're right. The thing that holds it together is that nobody in the middle of it is, so far, or at least not a lot of people that have been able to get and the press is a big part of the problem. The media is owned by them and everything, but you know, have been able to come out and say, "Oh no, all these people that are talking about these questions, they're right."
Yes, that's right.
You know, and I don't know when it happens. I imagine, and I do see it happening. I don't know how, but I do see it happening. And when it does, I imagine the herd will go exactly the way it should go. Hopefully, you know.
Yeah, and these people also are subjected to threats, intimidation, bribery, and even threats of being set up so that they will self-incriminate. And at that point, the message becomes very clear. You shut your mouth about what you know, or something very bad is going to happen. I mean, who at that point receiving that type of an ultimatum from their immediate supervisor, let's say, would dare to speak out at that point? Very few.
But it doesn't take many. And I think that more and more people are, well, I mean, maybe not more and more people, but I think that the small number of people that are making the decisions, you know, to have some courage and to do what they know they should do, you know, I'm hoping that that it's enough to you know, to shake the balance. And I guess maybe that's a good segue into my last question. And it has to do with current events and where we are today. I mean, it's been 6 years. We still don't have the truth, or at least many of us think that we don't have the truth. The wars rage on with 9/11 as the pretext for most of the military action that's going on around the whole planet. It's been contagious. In other words, as soon as the Americans said, well, you know, we can do this and that under the guise of, you know, the war on terror, well, then everybody else jumped on the bandwagon. So, well, then we can do that to our people, too. And, you know, I guess I'd like to just get your take on what do you think the current situation is and where do you think it might be going?
Well, unfortunately, the countries that that America and the Bush regime are going against at this point all have one thing in common, and that is they are moving away from the dollar and switching to the euro for trade purposes, whether that's in oil or some other commodity that's important to that country's export.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, and because America has been the world's reserve trading currency for the past 60-plus years, it's extremely important to the powers that be to keep that structure in place as long as possible. They are in the process of creating the Amero currency, which will be the currency of the North American Union. This is one of the things that is happening right now, where we're going to see the merging of Canada, the United States, and Mexico in a very similar fashion to the European Union. And so that's one thing that's going to happen. The other thing is that we are playing with fire over in the Middle East at this point. And several of the countries that we're going after have very high-level allies that would oppose America in a war. So we also pose the threat of World War III, where it looks like we're going to be going against China, Russia, and some of the other bigger countries in the Middle East, which will precipitate this larger escalation into these other areas and these other nations. Does this make us safer here at home? Absolutely not. Does any of our losing our liberties make us any safer? Absolutely not. Anything that's happened since 9/11 has not helped us in terms of making us safe, even with the claims to that effect from the Bush people. In addition to that, Mike, we have Dick Cheney, who, my opinion is, the man is criminally insane, and he's a complete psychotic, and he appears to be running the show over there. George Bush Jr., maybe he's in charge of the Oval Office pencil box, that's probably about it. So we need to get rid of Dick Cheney, and as long as these people are going to remain in power, we are in grave danger. But that doesn't mean we need to sit here and worry about this, because on one level they have overstepped their boundaries. They have become a little too arrogant.
Mm, I agree.
And at that point, we see them in a situation, especially with Bush Jr. right now, where he's kind of like circling the wagons around himself.
Mm, mm-hmm. And they're dropping like flies. I mean, the closest among him are falling off. Alberto Gonzalez being the most recent.
Yeah, I mean, all these people are resigning from their administrative posts, and this also does not help them. It actually does help us. So when it all comes to pass, I believe we should be good to go from our side of things. I believe ultimately these people will be defeated. I believe their downfall will be self-inflicted. And that's what I see for the future.
All right. We got time for one last quick one here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one I'm curious about, too. I'm not sure if you follow, how closely you follow the economic markets and this sort of thing, but there have been at least, well, one, but probably a number of very large bets, I guess is a good way to put it, placed on a significant market drop in the Dow, actually on a number of European stocks, but this would probably be reflected globally. Billions of dollars, actually, in puts that have been purchased and that will expire in the next couple of weeks. Essentially, this is a bet by somebody or some buddies that the markets are going to have a major downturn in the next couple of weeks, similar to some of the situations in the markets that occurred prior to 9/11. You got any comment on that?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, in the 1980s, I worked as an investment banker. So I'm very familiar, and I do watch the financial markets very closely. What it looks like is, at least through these puts that have been purchased, it looks like there may be some sort of an attack happening in Europe. I believe we're safe here in the U.S., I believe there may be something happening in Europe.
Okay. All right. Well, Kent, it has been a pleasure, and we are at the end of our proverbial rope here, but I just want to thank you and tell you how much I appreciate your work. And it's just, you know, the ongoing story, and I'm so glad that you're pursuing it with the courage and the sincerity that that you're doing.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. That really means a lot to me, and it helps me to continue.
All right. Well, I wish you the best, and we'll stay in touch, and I'll shoot you a quick note next couple of days once we get this thing up online, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you again. Enjoyed it.
I did as well, and enjoy the rest of your evening. Go get some rest, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay. Good night.